Well, no, quite. I did have a secretary when I was at the University of Oregon, and she was always bringing in her coffee, we thought. And on her retirement, she finally confessed that it was really vodka and tonic, getting her through the day. I appreciate your invitation to speak on foodways. I forget that I am sort of a food machine. The idea came from the choir director in Baton Rouge. We talked on the phone not too long ago, and she said, "Well, what have you been doing at the church?" And I said, "Well, you know, I sing." And, no, you've got to talk about food, since I had the reputation of sort of being the one that put together a lot of parties there. And so the idea comes from her. I should point out, too, the American Folklore Society will be meeting here in late October, bringing 1,000 folklorists from around the world. And it'll be a very exciting meeting. The session that I chair on foodways will be going on, but the guitarists get together in the evening, and I'll try to find out where they're going to be drinking beer if you want to hang out with them. And you're welcome, I think, to come to the session itself. So, as I say, like John Milton in Paradise Lost, I shall have to call on my muses. Three remarkable cooks in my case. One was my mother Vera, my sister Helen, and my wife Barbara. I have a nice chain. You see, I keep food in my life. Each one with her own story. My mother was a cook of the 30s and 40s, and we have many of her recipes, which probably wouldn't fly today. They're heavy on butters and other things. But she never missed an opportunity to supply such things when I was in grade school, such as hatchet cookies on George Washington's birthday. I'm told today you're not allowed to bring cookies to school anymore, but I enjoy the cookies. There is a gooseberry pie story I think that you might enjoy with her. We had a rather established 6 o'clock dinner hour in our home in Iowa, and my father didn't get home and hadn't called, and so finally he came in at 7 o'clock, and the dinner between we were served earlier, and so my mother and he were at the table, and it was a rather cool reception when he got home. And so after the dinner was served, the maid came in and said, "Mrs. Peterson, I can't find the pie." And she'd made a gooseberry pie, which was my father's favorite, which meant a trip across town to pick the gooseberries and come back and make the pie. And she said, "Oh, no, if Mr. Peterson wants pie this evening, he can find it in the garbage can." She was redheaded, so that means you can say those things. Then comes my sister, and my mother died in an early period in our lives. I was about 12, and my brother was 11. She returned from Vassar College, where she was studying, so she was in charge of Thanksgiving dinner. And so she created what we called, what we called hammer biscuits, and meaning that after we tried to eat the biscuits, we took them outside with a hammer and tried to crack them open. And but out of that came a very distinguished cook. My sister, who died a couple of years ago, went on to live in Paris and returned 10 years later as a very accomplished continental chef. She'd married a Frenchman, and her house was always a pleasure to visit around Christmas time and otherwise. And then along comes my wife, Barbara. She was in Baton Rouge the proprietor of a culinary business called Wok and Whisk, and where she did in cooking classes as well as provided catering for a number of weddings and other businesses that used her. And she probably had the reputation as the finest caterer in South Louisiana, often catering in Louisiana, in New Orleans, as well as Baton Rouge. She still is in the kitchen at my daughter's place in Eagle called Seasons. I think maybe there's a sort of an anti-hero here, and I think it has to be my mother-in-law, because she was not an accomplished cook at all, and I'm sure she would be wanting me to pass on her recipe for Christmas turkey. She wouldn't want me to, but I will. You get up at dawn and throw the oven on at full blast and thrust the bird into the oven, and it will surely be done when the last martini is finished. So I always thought of her as the champion of martinis, because she never served a turkey with wings or legs. They had already fallen off. In spite of the fact I gave her a meat thermometer. Well, but I thought today I would talk about three phases of historical, the evolution of kitchens today, I suppose. Sort of the caveman yielded to maybe the Italian influence. The Medici family, I think, brought haute cuisine, we'll say, to Italy. And then the French followed along with the influence of Marie Antoinette and others. The French don't agree with that, of course, but I think the Italians do come first. The Renaissance started there, of course. And their haute cuisine, which seems to become, and today it's resolved into what I'm calling another world of food called wham bam, thank you, ma'am, the drive-through window. And yet, before I conclude, I shall propose there's still another phase of contemporary cuisine. I'll start with the caveman image. I've been reading a book recently on what sort of converted, well, going from in evolution, man, the Homo sapien came about, and finally he had to, well, he learned to cook with fire. And that was sort of a step where the Homo sapien had surpassed the animal world, because they weren't really standing around cutting meat up or but I do have some experiences. But let's hear the first recording. This is a selection of music from Indonesia. Takes me to Bali, where I lecture occasionally, and I've been to events there where the men herd the swine into the courtyard, slay the pigs on location, and then they have to burn the skin off, and then they put the meat, which has been carefully cut up, on skewers, and they roast it. And I remember asking once, why are you taking the wood, bamboo, and cutting the skewer itself, rather than, I said, I just bought some skewers at the supermarket. You don't understand. This is something that we throw ourselves into to celebrate the event, the wedding or whatever it was. In this case, it was a tooth filing, and it's a three-day ceremony where everybody in the village is entertained, and the music that you just heard would be sort of the primitive instruments, flute and the the flute. All right. And I did go to an Indonesian wedding reception on a previous occasion, and sort of a novel approach there. When you get, you're immediately handed a plate and you start eating. This particular wedding, one table was set up for Muslims with no pork, and the other table was set up for the full feast, including pork. And the food was fabulous, and I was just snacking along. Finally, everybody's plate was down. I hadn't noticed, but they couldn't start the wedding until I had put my plate down. So it was time to get on with the ceremony. And oh, I'm so sorry to delay the ceremony. But sort of evolving from that early primitive state and then moving into the Renaissance, we get to something called sort of haute cuisine, and we'll hear a selection that I've selected from this. For this. Into what I have I went to a Belgian wedding once, and the music was similar to that, and it was in a sort of a theater setting, and I got there and found that the people on the first floor were seated and given dinner. I was a graduate student at this time in New York, and so then the first balcony was allowed to have cocktails, and I was in the second balcony, and we were allowed to watch, and that didn't appeal to me at all as a graduate student. I was half starving, probably. But the haute cuisine certainly caught on, and to dine at my sister's house would have meant something like a steamed artichoke with hollandaise sauce, followed by her husband's French preparation for roasted chicken cooked in wine, a haricot vert, or perhaps a beautifully prepared asparagus, followed by her greens with a heavy garlic dressing, and finally to the import cheese platter with maybe a fruit tart for dessert. These were often three-hour affairs. If they're in France, they would start at noon and be finished by 3 in time to go to bed. And but I'm saying the downside with that was if there was a shortcoming in the haute cuisine, it was the psychological demands that were put on the host and hostess trying to keep the thing alive while people were knocking themselves out in the kitchen. But not to put down that experience, we finally get to the contemporary scene, and I couldn't really think of a musical interlude that would handle McDonald's, so we'll skip that. And so the fast food thing, and yet I can sort of shift over from that. We lived in Salzburg for a while, and it was just wonderful to see the mom and pops coming to town, and they would grill worst at 10 o'clock in the morning. But remember, the Austrians like to eat 5 times a day. Breakfast consisted of maybe a roll with coffee. The worst and mustard was served at 11 o'clock. Then the heavy meal was at lunchtime, normally a soup followed by an entree and probably fruit dessert. But then don't skip 5 o'clock. That's when you have your wonderful dessert at the coffee house. And then finally, maybe something like a waffle-type dessert for dinner. And so you never went away hungry. I'm told that they've dropped, in Austria, they used to say, alles kommt mit Schlag, everything comes with whipped cream. And I think they've deleted the whipped cream in recent days because health issues have finally taken over. But I think that we find things where we do see people serving things with great pride. In our culture, the Saturday markets, the people who have specialized in... So it isn't just the cranking the truck, pulling in onto the grill and sending you on your way. And so it's really nice to see what comes that way. Well, those three phases, so we've had the caveman haute cuisine and the contemporary drive-through, but I think where my subtitle of When Wretched Excess is Barely Enough, I think now we're ready for that. And I said this has nothing to do with calories. I think I should start with, you've seen the movie Babette's Feast, I hope. And it's the French woman who, or maybe Danish woman, who went to France and returned. It's a film well worth seeing. You can rent it. And she comes back to a fundamentalistic culture where there was no alcohol, and they lived very, ate potatoes and a very basic meal. And when she, I believe she had married and inherited, or she had an inheritance. And so she took all of her money that she inherited and prepared a haute cuisine menu for the local fundamentalists. Well, they'd never had alcohol before, so they were a bit softened up with that. And finally they decided that was really, really quite an exceptional thing to do. Well, that's where we are, I think. Yes, that film is Wretched Excess. She really, she had fish, fresh fish sent in, and really great. But I think we see examples of wretched excess and of the various types of dining. I should refer to a Dutch experience I had some years ago. I was in a bar and met a young fellow, David, and we met the next day for coffee. And he said, well, my partner is a very good cook, and I would love to invite you for dinner at our house. But he said, now you're from Louisiana and he is from Suriname, he's black. And I said, oh well, no, I taught in a black university. I said there would be no problem there. So I went to the house, and we were eating on a card table with four mismatched plates, four mismatched forks, four mismatched chairs. If they were napkins, I'm sure they weren't matching either. The whole thing was mismatched. And yet I've never known anyone who threw himself in to prepare a meal with such passion, and passionate for the guests. And I just still remind him of that, and saying this was really perhaps one of the high points of dining, that it had nothing to do with the, it was just the passion that went into the preparation of the food. I had one experience at the Unitarian Church in Baton Rouge. I had invited a minister to, a young fellow who had graduated at Kenyon College, where I had graduated. He went public with having AIDS in the late 80s, and he went around to public schools explaining the easiest disease to avoid. So he, I called him and I said, you know, would you want to bring your show on the road? Yes, he would. So he came to Baton Rouge, so he spoke at the Unitarian Church on living in the face of illness. There were about 200 people there, and at the end of the service, half of the people just rushed him. He was a brilliant speaker. So I had gone off in the morning and simply thrown a leg of lamb on the grill, and I'd grilled it and put it over on the slow side of the grill, and I was gone for 3 hours, and on the way home I thought, the fire could have gone out. It could have burned the whole roast up, and it was a Unitarian miracle. It was the best leg of lamb I've ever made in my life. And we sat out there from 1 until 5 o'clock. The time passed as if it were 5 minutes, and just a glorious afternoon. So that was my Unitarian miracle. So I would like to convert it to what we do here. And yes, I'm sure that some passion goes into the food that comes here on the first Sunday of each month. We're talking, as I said, not calories, but we're talking pride in the presentation and the art of food. I've been here for nearly a year and have enjoyed seeing the creativity on the first Sunday menus, casseroles and hard-boiled eggs, assorted breads, fruit in various forms, potato salad, coleslaw, green salads, dessert in a wide variety of flavors. Perhaps a few of them would qualify as haute cuisine, but they do represent compassion, which is the ultimate thing, I think, as well as for themselves as guests. I take pride in what I do in the kitchen, and I hope it conveys that pride is in the dish. One last story. When I was a graduate student in New York, I was invited to the home of a doctor friend and his wife. And I would occasionally invite the wife to go to the theater with me because the doctor was always busy. And so I called one day and I said, well, can we go to the theater this evening? Sure, that's fine. She said, well, look, I've got three guests coming also. So I got to the house first, and I made my graduate school tuna fish noodles with cornflakes on top. And back then, that was a dish that was workable. And she said, now, the friend, if I'm not there, you just let the gentleman and the two women in. So a short Oriental man was there with two women, an older woman and a younger woman. And soon Mrs. Faulkner, the doctor's wife, arrived and said, oh, and did you meet the king? And I said, the who? And so, yes, he's the king of Nepal. And these are two of his 30 wives. And I went, no, I hadn't. And so the doctor came in and said, well, Dan, no offense, but we cannot serve the king tuna fish noodle casserole with cornflakes on top. To which Mrs. Faulkner, who was, she was T.S. Eliot's cousin, and she said, certainly you can serve them. They need to learn how we really live in this country. And so the king and the two wives and I had a chance to get together with the cornflakes. So in conclusion, I think that I've enjoyed seeing the interaction of not just the people of preparation of food, but the people who know how to set up tables and chairs and all of this. It's just a brilliant maneuver that goes on here without anyone saying anything, it seems. I know one thing is, don't linger in the kitchen. You'll get thrown out, which happens in my own kitchen at my daughter's restaurant. We'll always find a form of wretched excess in some way or other. I think if you look carefully at the table, just see what's there. It's not just the food, but also the art of the crew, as I said, who know how to put this together in the sanctuary. I understand probably better than anyone else the pain of the unspoken word. So I would really like to call on you to have... add something to my presentation on foodways and...